Good health is a crown worn by the healthy that only the ill can see. Your health really is your wealth. Join us for the next hour as we explore disease and attaining and maintaining good health. This is Dis-Chem Medical Monday, brought to you by Dis-Chem. Better health starts here.
Good morning. It's Monday morning, and or as I get told quite often by the fantastic listeners I bump into in public, sometimes it's Sunday morning. But right now, it's Monday morning, and you're listening to the Dis-Chem Medical Monday show here on 101.9 Chai FM. We have a fantastic guest in studio today, Sarah Walters, a genetic counselor, and we're going to be chatting all things genetics, but particularly with relation to Alzheimer's. So please let us have your questions for Sarah on 061-895-1019, and we'll put them to our guest. This is a big one for me, because there's not a lot in this world that I detest more than Alzheimer's and what it does to people and their families, having experienced this firsthand. So I'm really looking forward to this conversation. So let us have your questions for our guest. All right. So let's kick it off without any further ado. Sarah, welcome to the show. And thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. I've been on the show a couple of times, so I'm excited to talk to all your listeners again.
You obviously are doing a very good job, because you keep coming back. So
thank you.
I'm always holding thumbs, so just with the hope that I get invited back for next week's show, even though it's my show. But yeah, so it's no pressure. Let's chat about, firstly, what is genetic counseling? Why is it so important? And also, how does it relate to Alzheimer's?
So genetic counseling is a process of education and support around people who are either affected or at risk for getting a genetic condition. And so what we do is that we educate and explore about the condition itself. We explain the medical facts. We look at the risks for other family members. We also look at the risks for children, the future generations. And we discuss then the options that are available for them in terms of management and in terms of family planning.
Right. Because particularly with Alzheimer's, there's so much around this disease, because you end up with little moments of forgetfulness, a little bit of a change perhaps in temperament, and then suddenly you're living with a different person. And what's so heartbreaking is those moments of cognition sort of when they come back and
right,
then they fade. And,
yes.
Yeah, that must be incredibly stressful for the family, and exactly. not only for the patient. So yeah. Let's talk a little, how does genetic counseling help with that?
So we have to look at Alzheimer's as a whole and just look in terms of generality, in terms of the general population. Now, about 75% of cases of Alzheimer's are just occur from unknown reason. It might be partly genetic, it might be partly environmental, and that's what we call multifactorial. So multifactorial means that there's lots of factors that affect, but we're not always sure exactly what those factors are. So that accounts for 75% of Alzheimer's. Where the genetics comes in is when we have a familial type of Alzheimer's. Now, familial means obviously it's in the family, it's been seen before in the family, but there needs to be over three people in the family who have been diagnosed with Alzheimer's in order for it to be familial. Now, of the familial types, we have what we call the early onset and the older age of onset, or the late onset. So if we think about the early and the later onset, the sort of the barrier in the middle, not the barrier, the cutoff in the middle would be around about the age of 60 to 65. So some people will develop late onset familial Alzheimer's from the age of 60 or 65, and then an early onset can be below the age of 60 to 65.
Yes, right.
Sorry, just one little more portion.
No, go for it, please.
Many people who are affected with Down syndrome are at an increased risk for Alzheimer's as well. So our aging adults with Down syndrome from about the age of 40 and onwards might be affected by Alzheimer's.
Okay. Sure. Now, for most of us, Alzheimer's is for people sort of over the age of 60. It's setting in, sort of a little bit later in life. And you would then be saying, okay, so what's the research around it in terms of, let's say, modern research or more current research? Because it is, there's not a lot of information in terms of the population. Well, let me say it this way. The boomers are coming through now. So there's a bigger population group to be dealing with and to understand. So not to say that there's not a lot of information. There's more information now. How are you seeing the treatments, both with families, with genetic counseling, happening now with this bigger population group coming through?
So we don't really deal with treatment. We'd rather refer on to a geriatrician or a psychiatrist to deal with with the actual Alzheimer's itself. What we do is that we have a look in the family context to see whether there could be an inherited predisposition to getting Alzheimer's. So there's several ways. Can I continue? There's several ways in
Sure,
which
please
this
go
can
for it.
occur. So for quite a while, we've known about the APOE gene. So the APOE gene is not a diagnostic marker for Alzheimer's, but there are three forms of the APOE gene. There's E2, E3, and E4. And if someone has got one copy of E4 or two copies of E4, they are in an increased risk for getting Alzheimer's above the general population. So in the general population, the more common form of the APOE gene is the E2 version. And so the E2 version is protective against Alzheimer's. But like I said, that is just a predisposition gene. It's not diagnostic.
So I want to go into this a little bit more as soon as we're back from this ad break, particularly from the point of view as I'm adopted, so I have no family history. So to look something at that, are there tests available and so on? So let's get to that after this ad break.
This is Medical Monday, brought to you with the compliments of Dis-Chem. Better health starts here.
Thank you so much for joining us today on the Dis-Chem Medical Monday show here on 101.9 High FM. We're chatting with Sarah Walters, genetic counselor. And this is really where I get excited, Sarah, because genetics are an opportunity, perhaps for someone like me who is adopted and doesn't have a family connection to the past, to look at what the potential risks might be. Just before we went to ad break, you were chatting about the three different types that you look for. Can we carry on a little bit with that and then perhaps go into the role that genetic counseling plays?
So I spoke about the early onset and the late onset. And so, as well as the APOE gene that I have spoken about, there are several other genes that are called susceptibility genes. So, in the literature, there's around about 20 genes that are responsible for having for creating a susceptibility. And it's not always diagnostic, but it does increase your risk in terms of the family history. And remember that even late onset familial Alzheimer's is you have to have three or more people diagnosed in the family.
In
So
the
in your case, we don't have that. So people who are adopted, we don't have we don't have any history unless you try and trace back your birth parents and try to find out history that way. But just in terms of say you've got a biological brother, for example, that you know and has been diagnosed with Alzheimer's at 60, then when we're doing genetic testing, the best person to test initially would be someone who is affected. And the reason for that is that the set of genes that we test for, if it's positive, then we know that that is the gene that is causing or contributing towards the Alzheimer's. However, if it's negative, then none of the genes are then contributing to the Alzheimer's. It must be due to something else, either some other gene or a multifactorial component. So there's little point when you've got a family history that is known in testing a person who is unaffected, because you've got to have it's best to know the gene that's involved in the first place. However, in your kind of case, if it's something that you are concerned about, there are a set of genes that that can be tested, that will, so either to look at the susceptibility gene, depending on your age and whether you've even started with signs of it. And then obviously the first place that a person would go if they suspect a diagnosis of Alzheimer's or forgetfulness, or wonder if it's just aging, normal aging, would be likely to a neurologist. And the neurologist then would do scan, brain scans, et cetera, to see if there's buildup of plaques and stuff in the brain. So that'd be the first place to go. However, if we're looking at the early onset of Alzheimer's, there's a few genes that we could look at to know whether there is a definite gene that is causing the Alzheimer's. And those genes are inherited in what we call an autosomal dominant manner. So that means that if you have a parent who is affected, there's a fifth, and have been shown to be whichever gene positive for Alzheimer's. I've forgotten my train of thought now. If there's a positive, then there's a 50% chance for the children of that person to have inherited that autosomal dominant gene. So it's a 50-50 in terms of the children of the affected parent. But we have to be careful because some of the genes have got what we call reduced penetrance. So what that means is that even though you inherit the faulty gene, it doesn't always show itself or show itself. Yeah, I mean, over the age of 80, it will probably about that time it will have shown itself. But in terms of the early onset, so remember that's usually below 60. Sometimes, even though a person has inherited that faulty gene, they don't always show the signs of it until a little bit later.
It's interesting when you talk about sort of at the age of 60, and when I was younger, 60 seemed so far away, and now
That's
it's just
horrible.
5.5 years away. So it is coming up quite quickly. If you have any questions for our guest, Sarah, let us get them from you on our WhatsApp number, 061-895-1019. With regards to genetics and what is being learnt and seen now, I think the more we learn about our genetics, the more we can prepare or alter our lifestyle and so on. So one of my, I'd like to say, responsibilities for our listeners is to watch what's going on medically in trends online. So there's a lot of nonsense around that, and but there's some good stuff. And now there's a lot of talk around type 3 diabetes or diabetes of the brain with relation to Alzheimer's, and saying, excessive sugar can be a contributing factor. With early detection with three or more family members, with the counseling that you do, is it also geared towards altering lifestyle to maintain cognitive function as long as possible?
Yeah, so what we, I mean, I think anyone who ever goes to their GP, they say to them, eat healthily, 5 fruit and vegetables a day, drink enough water, et cetera, et cetera. So we know that mantra. We all know what we are supposed to be doing. So the question is, are we doing that? And are you sticking to it? And I think because we hear it so much as well, people tend to forget, and it's much easier to go to takeaway or whatever. But as long as that's not the norm, then and you are looking after your dietary health, and your brain health. So one of the things that I always talk about in terms of Alzheimer's or other onset dementias are doing brain training. So we can get lots of apps on our phone in terms of brain training, doing the Wordle, doing Sudoku, doing any of the brain training games to keep your brain flexible, the neuroplasty going. So I mean, there's lots of apps, and I often one of them's called Luminosity. I think it's still free. And I always say, have you played this? Have you played that? Have you played the other? It's easy. You're sitting in the tax office, you're waiting an hour for your appointment, and you can sit there on your phone doing brain training. So it's so easy. I do the Wordle first thing every morning, have a competition with my mom. So how many tries did you get the Wordle in? And it's great because it keeps that brain going. for as long as possible.
I think that's it. The brain's basically, I mean, we talk about it as the brain is a muscle, right? We use it or lose it. And I'm a big advocate, and I do it for myself often, maybe because it's my dyslexia or my ADHD, but taking on new tasks and challenges and things that I've never done before. So whether it's delving into photography or videography or some kind of programming on a computer, learning these new things, I think does help tremendously. I'd like your, you know, sort of if that ties in with what we were saying, what is your thoughts on sleep in terms of cognitive health and brain health?
I know someone in Natal who's busy finishing her PhD on sleep and the importance of sleep in women's, she's particularly focused on women, but in terms of sleep health and how it affects your daily functioning. So not everybody needs the same amount of sleep, and that's why they average it between like 7 to 8 hours of sleep. Some people can function very well on 4 hours of sleep, certainly not me. But what's also important is that we need to get the deep sleep, the REM, and the light sleep as well. And we need to get them in the right sort of quantities. So sleep hygiene, as she always talks about, is so important. So going to bed at a regular time, not eating cheese or coffee or having coffee or anything that is a stimulant before, from 2 hours before you go to bed. Having your room at a certain temperature that will encourage you to fall asleep. Making sure that you don't get disturbed during the night. I know lots of people who have dogs sleeping on their bed, or look, if you've got small children, I can understand that. But, you know, what you want to do is minimize the possibility of interruptions in your sleep.
I think that I read something a while ago, sort of the great rules where no food, I mean, in an ideal world, no food 3 hours before you go to sleep, because I find that's a big interrupter for me. No screens 2 hours before you go to sleep. And start prepping. Yeah, correct. And start prepping for your sleep an hour before. You know, I think it's, if we just made sleep more of a priority, I think our quality of life would drastically improve. But I think, unfortunately, very much in South African culture, and hello, given what you do in the field that you're in, anyone in the medical field, you know, it's almost a badge of honor with interns to do 72 hours straight and all of these kind of things and maintain sort of their cognitive function and their mental health. And I don't think we can ever make sleep back. They're optimal. That's it. I think it's very much about being optimal. If people are exposed to family members that are suffering and they see what's happening, you know, it's like my father or my mother has it, or my grandparents have it, you know, there's a lot of emotional stress around that. How do you work with patients in terms of dealing with that emotional stress, that anxiety, that fear?
So as a genetic counselor, we are trained in counseling skills as well. And we know that, you know, it's something that is genetic. It was not given to you on purpose. It wasn't passed on purpose, or you didn't get it on purpose. And so there's often a lot of guilt, which we explore. And we emphasize the fact of inheritance, and that, you know, you don't purposefully give any faulty genes to your children. But also we talk about coping skills. So we do some basic kind of counseling around the emotions attached to the diagnosis and to the genetics. However, if we recognize sort of triggers or some more in-depth pathology, we'd rather refer to clinical psychologists who will be able to work with that person on an ongoing basis. So explaining the genetics and understanding the emotional state of the family that you're speaking to is a start. And some people are manage or identify their coping skills. They've got people to talk to, or maybe they've joined a support group, or maybe there's, you know, other family members who they are comfortable talking with. But sometimes they don't want to talk with family members. It's all too close. So reaching out to a support group or another kind of group. I'm sure that there's an Alzheimer's support group, and then I know that there's another one. I've forgotten its name now, but it's also it's like the supporters helping each other. It's a mutual support support group. So those we find are very helpful, because then you've got the support people saying, yes, I've dealt with that before, or this has happened to me before, and this is how I dealt with it. So the coping mechanisms also are different between different people. So we try to get people to identify their own coping skills.
Right. And I think it's, you know, the coping skills are interesting. If I look at my own personal experience, the people in the family and the person are trying the very best that they can. Just as you said, with no one passes on bad genes intentionally.
Exactly.
Everybody is really trying to cope to the best possible level that they can. And I think we also need to be cognizant of that. If we look at the practicality of the genetic, what is the testing process? What is the process when someone comes to see you? Are they referred to you? And how does that work? What are the mechanics behind it?
So usually patients and families are referred by either the neurologist or a psychiatrist who they've gone to initially to find out about the diagnosis and then be diagnosed with Alzheimer's. So sometimes it's a family that is searching for an answer, and we do what we call pre-test counseling, which is always the best. And then we refer them to the psychiatrist or the neurologist or whoever they need. Pre-test genetic counseling is always better, because what we do then is that we gather the family history to have a look to see who's affected in the family, what ages were they when they were diagnosed, is there anything else that is genetically could be being passed through the family as well, because it would be so negligent if I only concentrated on the Alzheimer's, yet there's a huge history of some other genetic condition in the family. And then we explain genetics just in general, because high school grade 12 was probably a very long time ago for some people. So we explain the genetics.
Before the war.
I always talk about the ARC, when the ARC was being made.
Yes.
So so we explain about the genetics and how it gets inherited, explain autosomal dominant inheritance. We also explain about the genes and how they work and what they do, so that they have an understanding of how a faulty gene makes a faulty protein, which then cannot work in the body properly, or is a faulty protein that can't function, but it builds up in the body somewhere. So, and then causing damage to nervous tissue by building up. So we talk about all of that. We talk about who in the family could be affected. We talk about the genetic testing. Now, the testing itself is actually really simple. It's a blood draw. So it's peripheral blood. So blood from your arm. And we need a teaspoonful of blood. So one tube of blood, which is about 5 milliliters, that's all we need to get enough DNA to target the genes that we're interested in looking at and then to sequence them. So by sequencing, it means like reading the recipe of the gene to see if it is all correct.
Okay. And how long does that process usually take from meeting with you through to getting the results?
So it depends on where the testing is done. So genetic testing in general takes around about 4 weeks, but it depends on what we're looking at. Are we looking at one gene or are we looking at several genes? So obviously the more genes we look at, the longer it's going to take, because it's not the actual sequencing which is an issue, because that can happen within a week. But it's the analysis of each of the different genes that we're looking at. We have to trawl through each and every single part of the recipe to see that everything is as it should be.
Okay.
And then
I want to touch it.
Sorry,
go
just
ahead.
Until we get the results in, could be around about 4 weeks, or, like I said, it just depends on how many genes.
When we're back from ad break, I want to touch on your experience of the value of the genetic counseling and what you do in helping the families, not only of the patient, but the families, and also for them to prepare themselves in terms of their own health and well-being. But we'll get back to that straight after our ad break. We are chatting right now with Sarah Walters, genetic counselor. And we're touching on primarily Alzheimer's. Let us have your questions for our guest on 061-895-1019 here on 101.9 High FM.
This is Medical Monday, brought to you with the compliments of Dis-Chem. Better health starts here.
You've been listening to the Dis-Chem Medical Monday Show here on 101.9 Chai FM. We are chatting with Sarah Walters, a genetic counselor. Absolutely fascinating, fascinating conversation, and something that's very, very close to my heart, having gone through this with my late grandfather and seeing what it did to my grandmother, to the family, and everyone trying their very best, including my granddad, who was, you know, just trying to be there, coming from this very strong, powerful leader of the family to someone who needed to be cared for. What I wanted to ask just before we went to ad break, and let us have your questions for our guest on our in-studio WhatsApp number, 061-895-1019. And we were touching on the value of what you do in your experience, what you've seen, the benefit of genetic counseling. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
I think we'd have to ask our patients and families about that. But what I do see is like a light bulb switching on many times, because I know that medical practitioners talk to patients, and a lot of the time they use a lot of medical speak. So they use medical words without explaining what they are. And what we do in the genetic counseling is unravel that as well, is to translate all of these big long terms or terminology, medical terminology, into something that is understandable for the patient or the family. And also we explain what a gene is, what its function is, where are the genes, how many do we have, what do we do with them, and how important it is. We talk about reproduction as well, so how you make children from a genetics point of view. So
sugar and spice and all of that stuff, right?
I'm sure all of that nice stuff to make girls. So we do talk about that in terms of genetics, in terms of how you pass on genetic information to the next generation. Even for people who are highly educated, you know, I did work at some of our hospitals where previously, where a lot of our population was maybe had a standard five, I'm showing our age, standard five, grade seven, and maybe they didn't have the opportunity to study further, or people who had finished matric but also didn't have an opportunity to study further. But it doesn't matter who you are. If you've never gone down the line of being interested in genetics, you're not going to understand the technicalities of it anymore. So genetic counselors make it easily digestible information for families.
So it's almost you're a translator from doctor speak to members of the public speak.
Yes. And that's why I talk about, when I talk about a gene, I often talk about making a chocolate cake, and that you've got a specific sequence in which you have to add the genes, and your protein or your product at the end of the gene or the end of the recipe needs to be a chocolate cake. But if anything changes in the recipe for the chocolate cake, you don't get a chocolate cake, and you want a chocolate cake. But if you get
a vanilla, want a chocolate,
it works the same.
Absolutely. Absolutely. The thing for me, which always sits in my mind, and I think maybe it's just being a guy, it's a male thing. And I suppose if I mentioned this to any wife or mom out there, she would agree that, you know, we don't really like to take care of ourselves if we get a problem. I think this is also why women have longer longevity, that if there's something wrong, you go and deal with it. We try to pack stuff away, not deal with it. You know, cowboys don't cry, pack it under the... Do you find that once people talk to you that they're more willing to do what needs to be done and wanting to avoid sort of, you know, the reality of the situation?
So some people do. You have to remember that doing anything further after we've spoken to them is an individual choice. And so what we can do is provide the information, we can provide them the access, we can help them make appointments, we can do whatever, you know, needs to be. But if the person themselves is not willing to go there, we can take a horse to water, you know the saying. So what we do is try to smooth the passage to helping people. Some people prefer to not deal with it and stick their heads in the sand, and that's okay. Because that's their coping mechanism at the time. But sometimes what happens is that 2 or 3 years later, we'll get a phone call and we'll say, remember you saw me all those years ago, I'm now ready to deal with it. And that's okay.
Sure.
We have to go at the pace that the patient wants to go.
Right. That's such an important point. And, it just, I've mentioned it a few times on the show. I've been sober for 18 years. And there's a big thing in any addiction, whether it's Narcotics Anonymous, Alcoholics Anonymous, whatever, saying this too shall pass. And when you said, and I think it's also for the families, perhaps, that if someone in the family is saying, I'm not dealing with this, that they're not dealing with it now, as opposed
Correct.
to things may change over the next couple of years. And I think that's such wonderful sort of something to share and advice for them.
And can I just add, sorry, can
Please,
I just
please.
add something? Sometimes, when people are going through really stressful periods in their lives, for example, at the time of a pregnancy or the time that's recently after someone's passing, or a divorce or something like that, we prefer to delay the genetic counseling because we have the potential for possibly more bad news in a way. And so what we like to preferably do, if possible, is to delay it a little bit until the person is in a mental and emotional state where they're able to cope with all of this new kind of information. So it does depend on coping strategies, coping skills, and support people around. But we prefer not to do it during those very stressful times. And often what we find as well is that we have what we call family pressure. So if you've got potentially two or three children that could be tested for a genetic condition, some are coerced by other family members or their siblings into having the testing when they don't really want to. And so what we try and do is to tease out who really wants to get genetic testing and who really doesn't want to get genetic testing. So what I try to do sometimes is to actually separate people out. So even if they come as a family, I will then maybe have a consultation with one of the siblings that you can see is like, okay, I'll do it. But you can see that they're really not in the right place or wanting to do it. And it's okay because you don't have to be pressured by your family into doing something. You're an adult. You have to make your own decisions.
Right. This is a Jewish radio station primarily, right? And you talk about Jewish moms and dads. You can be 75 and you're not an adult, but not to make light of this, but
Yeah, I hear you, but it's not only Jewish families that are affected. I promise.
No, I know it's 100%. We're
Yes.
going to go to ads now. When we come back, I'd just like to touch on the South African healthcare system and sort of what's available to people around the country. All right, let's go to ads.
This is Medical Monday, brought to you with the compliments of Dis-Chem. Better health starts here.
You've been listening to the Dis-Chem Medical Monday show here on 101.9 High FM. We've been chatting with Sarah Walters, genetic counselor. We've been touching on primarily the disease of Alzheimer's, its effects, and how genetic counseling plays a role in that. Just before we went to ads, we made a little bit light of sort of, Jewish families where you're never an adult, but in reality, as you said, you are an adult and you need to stand up for yourself. And as Professor Lucille Bloomberg said before on the show, patient empowerment. So,
Really?
it's up to you to determine that. Within South Africa, we've got serious health. Oh, go ahead.
Sorry, I was just going
I'm sorry.
to add on to that conversation and saying, even though the genetic testing is still the same for everyone or maybe tailored towards the family, genetic counselors are well versed into taking cultural norms and issues into account as well. So we do understand, yes, we had a giggle, but we do try and understand everybody coming from their own cultural perspective and what is allowed, what is not allowed, how things work in a particular family, even a particular family, you know, nuclear family, could have its own way of doing things, which we have to respect. And we do. And so that's why we work with families. And like I said, also, it may take time for them to decide about whether to go ahead with testing or not.
You know, that's the thing that I'm picking up from this conversation with you. There's a great deal of sensitivity to the patient and enhancing the quality of life. So no pressure, but providing what's available. And I think that sort of did answer the question, because I was going to be asking in terms of, we know South Africa has a limited capacity in what it's able to offer in public healthcare, with amazing people working within public healthcare, but it is taking the different cultures into account and being sensitive to that. So just as we start to wrap up the show, what would you like to close off the conversation with? What do you feel is valuable to share that we may not yet have shared?
In terms of Alzheimer's, if you are unsure, contact a genetic counselor. Have a 5-minute discussion about whether a genetic counseling appointment would be valuable to them, if it would help them in any kind of way. We have a limited number of genetic counselors in the country. We do have the majority working in the public sector, so there's in Cape Town specifically and Johannesburg. And then in the private sector, we also have. So we here at Ampath, we have 3 genetic counselors, but there are other genetic counselors working in private as well. So Google them, find out, have a chat, see if it's worth it for you to, you know, for a genetic counseling session to answer your questions. You might end up in a genetic counseling session where no genetic testing is appropriate or offered. It all depends on what condition we are talking about. So in the private sector, a lot of genetic testing is more available than in the public sector. However, not all of it is paid by medical aid as well. So we have to, everybody has to weigh up how much is going to use all of my savings. Everybody has a perception that genetic testing is really expensive. Well, it can be, but it depends on what you're testing for. So medical aids do pay for some genetic testing. Some of them they don't. Sometimes we have to write motivation letters. Sometimes we need to send testing overseas, and it's not always as expensive as people expect.
That's also a sense that I'm getting from this conversation, is that you're not powerless around the disease of Alzheimer's, and that there's a lot that you can do.
There's a lot we can do and offer.
That's a wonderful way to end the show and to wrap up. Sarah Walters, genetic counselor, thank you so much for your time. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much, ladies.
It was great chatting with you. To our fabulous listeners, thank you for joining us today and being part of the show. I'm looking forward to chatting with you on Monday. Big thanks to Craig for pushing the buttons, Sina for getting us awesome guests like Sarah, and have a fab week. I'll chat with you guys again on Monday.